Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 2nd, 2017, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Don't Go Breaking My Heart, the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale. And our guest skeptic is Dr. Justin Morgenstern. He is an emergency physician and the director of simulation education at Markham Stouffville Hospital in Ontario. He is the author of the excellent FOMED blog called First 10 EM and is an associate editor of Emergency Medicine Cases. Welcome back to the SGEM, Justin.
As always, it's a pleasure to be back and talking nerdy with you.
Love talking nerdy. But you just got back from Sunbeam in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, you know, if our listeners have never been to a BEAM course before, I would highly recommend it. It's a great way to familiarize yourself with the most recent evidence in an intimate setting and cut that knowledge translation window down to less than 1 year. I got the inside scoop for next year. It sounds like Sunbeam is going to be in Costa Rica, so keep your eyes out for that one.
Pura Vida in Costa Rica. Nice. Well, you should be rested and ready to go for an SGEM hop. That's hot off the press.
Absolutely. So let's just jump right into the juicy bits, the evidence.
Whoa. Before we get into the evidence, let's just remind the SGEMers about the SGEM hop process. And this time we're doing a paper from AEM.
Right. So first we pick a pre-publication paper from the AEM that we think the SGEMers would think is important. And then we do a structured critical review based on the best evidence in emergency medicine quality checklist.
Then one of the authors is invited to come on the SGEM and discuss the strengths and weaknesses of the study. And we have got a big name for you today.
And then a blog and podcast is uploaded as part of the free open access medical education initiative.
SGEMers then have 1 week, only 1 week, to provide that feedback, comments, and ask questions of the authors with the best social media interaction getting published in AEM.
And fantastic news, there are also CME credits linked to this AEM paper that can be claimed by clicking on a link.
Ultimately, cutting that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year using the power of social media.
So to speed up the process, let's jump right into a case. So this time, we have a 68-year-old woman with a history of congestive heart failure, hypertension, and hyperlipidemia. She presents to the emergency department with a 3-day history of shortness of breath on exertion, orthopnea, and mild leg edema, but with normal vital signs. Her renal function is normal, and troponin is negative. Her ECG is normal. After a dose of furosemide, she says she feels a lot better, and she'd like to go home.
Well, heart failure is a serious condition that often presents to the emergency department. Guidelines exist to help physicians on the diagnosis and treatment of heart failure, but none offer recommendations on who to admit.
Heart failure patients often have other comorbid conditions, increasing their rate of hospitalization. In addition, patients hospitalized for heart failure have a high risk of readmission to hospital after discharge.
Patients in Canada are more often treated in the emergency department and discharged home compared to the U.S. This difference is similar to what we've seen in patients diagnosed with pulmonary embolism, and we've discussed this issue before on SGEM number 51.
So who can go home and who needs to come into hospital is a question faced regularly by emergency physicians.
Well, there are published risk stratification tools to predict mortality in patients with acute heart failure, but they are limited in their ability to inform the emergency physician in deciding disposition, admit or discharge home. So, Justin, what's the clinical question?
So our clinical question is, can the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale help make disposition decisions by accurately predicting the 30-day rate of serious adverse events in patients with acute heart failure?
And what's the reference for this?
So we're looking at Steele et al., prospective and explicit clinical validation of the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale with and without use of quantitative NT-proBNP, and obviously it's in AEM 2017.
All right, let's run through that PICO. What was the population?
So they were looking at adult patients over 49 years of age, presented to emergency department with shortness of breath less than 7 days of duration due to acute heart failure.
Acute heart failure was defined by the Task Force for the Diagnosis and Treatment of Acute and Chronic Heart Failure of the European Society of Cardiology 2008. Who did they exclude?
So the major exclusion to know about is they excluded patients who did not fit the definition of acute heart failure or who were too sick to be considered for discharge after 2 to 12 hours in the emergency department.
We'll put up the exact details for those exclusions in the blog post. How about the intervention?
So they were looking at the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale. Now, this is a slightly involved scale, and I'd always use an app to calculate it, but it's essentially broken down into three easy components: your initial clinical assessment, some investigations, and then a walk test after treatment. The full scale can be found on the SGEM website for reference.
All right, and did they have a comparison group?
No, they did not.
How about the primary outcome?
So their primary outcome was serious adverse events. That includes death from any cause at 30 days.
Well, that would probably be a very serious adverse event. And then also they had any of the following in the next 14 days, and that was admission to a monitored unit, endotracheal intubation or non-invasive ventilation, myocardial infarction, major procedure or relapse, and hospital admission for those patients originally discharged home.
There were a couple secondary outcomes as well. They looked at how well each component of the score performed. They looked at the performance of the score with or without the NT-proBNP, and they also looked at physician accuracy and the acceptability of the score to physicians.
Well, we're excited and honored to introduce one of the most famous emergency medicine researchers in the world and the creator of so many clinical decision rules, Dr. Ian Steele. Welcome to the SGEM.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here, guys.
Well, you and I have had a long-standing back and forth about calling these things rules or tools, haven't we?
Pretty much. You never listen to me.
No, I do listen to you. And, you know, one of the cool things about the SGEM Hop is we get the author on, and they get to read their own conclusions. So I don't even have to say quote. So, Ian, what were the conclusions to your paper?
Okay, so a prospective clinical validation found that the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale tool was highly sensitive for serious adverse events in acute heart failure patients, albeit with an increase in admission rates. When available, NT-proBNP values further improve sensitivity. With adequate physician training, the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale should help improve and standardize admission practices, diminishing both unnecessary admissions for low-risk patients and unsafe discharge decisions for high-risk patients.
All right, Justin, let's run through the quality checklist for clinical decision tools. The first one was the study population. Did it include or focused on those in the ED?
Yes, it did.
And the patients, were they representative of those with the problem?
We're not sure. We'll get to that in the talking nerdy section.
Were all important predictor variables and outcomes explicitly specified?
Yes.
Is this a prospective, multi-center study, including a broad spectrum of patients and clinicians?
Yes, it was.
Clinicians interpret individual predictor variables and score the clinical decision rule reliably and accurately.
Although the clinicians could predict the individual parts of the score accurately, they had more trouble with the whole score together, so we gave this one a no.
And number six, this is an impact analysis of a previously validated CDR.
No.
For level one studies, impact on clinical behavior and patient-centric outcomes is reported.
So this is inapplicable.
And the follow-up was sufficiently long enough and complete?
We think probably yes here.
All right, and the last question, the effect was large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant.
Again, not sure. We'll get into that in the nerdy section.
All right, let's run through the key results. The study enrolled 1,100 patients with a mean age of 78 years, 53% being male and 44% arriving by ambulance. Of the study population, 43% were discharged home from the emergency department and 57% were admitted to hospital at the index ED encounter.
Now, it's important to note that the NT-proBNP, which is part of the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale, was measured in only 62% of the patients. In terms of the primary outcome, the serious adverse event rate was 15.5%. It was about 19% for patients who were admitted to hospital and 10% of those who were discharged from the emergency department.
Overall mortality, probably the most important adverse event, was 3.7%. There were numerous other adverse events that we would consider important when considering a potential discharge, such as the need for non-invasive ventilation, intubation, and myocardial infarctions. These can all be found in Table 3 of the paper. But how about secondary outcomes, Justin?
Yeah, so when you look at each of the individual components of the score, most seem to perform well in predicting adverse events. They, again, can be found in Table 3.
Yeah, the performance of the scale without, that's without, NT-proBNP, a score of equal to or greater than 1, was about 92% sensitive for serious adverse events, as compared to ED physician decisions, which was about 72% sensitive. However, this would have raised admission rates from about 58% to 78%.
So if you look at this score with the NT-proBNP, a score of greater than or equal to 1 was 95.8% sensitive for these serious adverse events. When you compare that to the emergency physician decision, that was only 70% sensitive. However, once again, it would have raised admission rates from 60% to 88%.
Now, physicians were asked to place the patients into four different risk categories: low, medium, high, or very high. This was compared to criterion interpretation, and it resulted in agreement 59% of the time.
Physicians also rated on a 5-point scale whether or not they were comfortable using the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale. Physicians reported being uncomfortable or very uncomfortable using the scale about 12% of the time.
Because of these decision tools, not rules, we might be able to use different cutoffs to guide shared decision making. Using a score of greater than or equal to 2 had similar sensitivity for severe adverse events when compared to physician judgment, 72%-ish, but would have decreased admission rate from 57% down to 48%. All right, Justin, now let's bring Ian back and we're going to talk a little nerdy and find out more about this study. So, Justin, what's the first question?
So, as always, we have five major themes here, and our first one is about eligibility. So, many patients were screened for this study, but in total, only about 37% ended up being eligible for the study.
Well, let's run through the top five reasons why the patients weren't eligible.
So the first reason was patients having shortness of breath for greater than 7 days. But many patients have chronic shortness of breath with heart failure who decompensate and present to the emergency department. So our first question, Ian, is why did you exclude these patients?
Well, we see a lot of patients that are not acutely ill. And this rule is really intended for acute decompensated heart failure. So we had a lot of folks that were there and were screened appropriately by our team. And really, we're not the type of patient that we would consider acute heart failure.
All right. Another group that was excluded was if they didn't have clear evidence of heart failure on the chest X-ray. And we know that chest X-ray lacks sensitivity for congestive heart failure. So why not include patients that physicians felt were in acute heart failure regardless of the chest X-ray finding?
And we did. The inclusion, and as we described, it's based on the European Society of Cardiology guidelines for diagnosing heart failure, which really depends on a picture. There's no gold standard for diagnosing heart failure in the ED, or there certainly wasn't when we did this study. So it's a combination of history, findings, response to therapy, do they get better after diuretics, and the X-ray. So if this line should have said they really didn't meet any, you know, on balance, they didn't meet our definition of heart failure. So it was more than just the X-ray.
Fair enough.
And at the time of this, we did a few POCUS studies, but for the most part, the vast majority of patients did not have lung ultrasound performed in the ED.
Absolutely. So the next reason that patients weren't eligible is just because research is very expensive and hard to do. So patients weren't enrolled consecutively. Only patients presenting between 8 a.m. and midnight were included. CHF patients presenting at night might be different from those presenting during the daytime hours, and nighttime discharges could be higher risk than those during the day.
Well, that's the way it is. And we don't think those patients are a whole lot different. They might be more acutely. Also, the pulmonary edemas are going to come in around the clock. But otherwise, we didn't think there was any particular selection bias that would make you think that this really wasn't, you know, with the huge number of patients that we had, 1,100 patients, we think we had a very good representation of what we typically see in our EDs in Canada.
All right. One other group was patients from nursing homes or long-term care facilities. Why did you specifically exclude these patients? I mean, they represent a significant portion of heart failure patients we see and would like to be able to send them back to their, quote, home. Do you think the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale could be applied to these patients?
It definitely can. The issue was that we were, the whole purpose of this is to help docs make disposition decisions, and we felt that those that can be easily returned to a long-term care facility are in a totally different category than patients who are coming from their own home or retirement home. But nevertheless, I think the findings can be, could well be applied to those folks.
Finally, we also excluded patients with confusion, disorientation, or dementia. We were just wondering, did you use a validated score to assess confusion, disorientation, or dementia, or was it based on clinical gestalt?
It was mostly a level of consciousness. So if the patient, you know, was drowsy or not able to converse clearly with the physician or the research team, we felt it wasn't appropriate to include them. And I would guess other those with dementia, you know, the rule probably applies. Those that were, excuse me, acutely confused and disoriented were probably too sick, really, to worry about whether they were being admitted or not. It's in the same category as those with extremely abnormal vital signs.
All right. Well, the second major issue we wanted to talk about was enrollment. 41% of the patients were not enrolled if clinical staff was too busy with other patient care responsibilities. Does this mean that this Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale would be too time-consuming to adopt into clinical practice a large part of the time?
Not at all, no. This meant the staff weren't around, and it mostly referred to in our hospital, night hours. We ran the study 7 days a week. Some sites only ran them during the week because of staffing considerations. So it varied between the sites. But the application of this scale by a doctor for whom it's intended, the doctor, is very straightforward and easy.
Excellent. So our third area of discussion is the scoring itself. Now here, physicians were aware of the patient's risk category on the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale when they were making their disposition decisions. Although they were explicitly told not to base their decisions solely on this instrument, there would be a risk of incorporation bias here.
Absolutely. This is a real-time clinical study. Other risk scales are derived from databases, but this required the involvement of the treating ED physician. So it's normal that they would want to consider this extra information. And we saw the admission rate actually increased a fair bit in this study compared to our derivation study. But I don't see that this would in any way bias the primary outcome, which is the occurrence of serious adverse events.
Well, physicians were not very accurate when they used the entire score. Furthermore, more than 10% of physicians indicated they were uncomfortable using the score. How will this affect its generalizability and impact going forward?
Yeah, these are good points, really good points, actually. And part of an important part of real-time clinical validation is evaluating the acceptance and usefulness to the practicing physician. So that's why we emphasized in our conclusion that the doctors need to be trained. And what was a tad disappointing is that obviously they could interpret the 10 findings. They're pretty straightforward clinical findings, but they were a little slack at actually adding up the score. I think doctors with like 13 years of post-secondary education could probably add up a score, but I think they often were not focused or paying attention. And I'd like to think that when this becomes more integrated into the practice, they'll take a little bit more time to actually do the simple math.
Just so everybody in the audience understands what Ian's saying here is the primary outcome here was based on the criterion interpretation of the individual score components. So that basically means whatever the individual components of the score were was what was used as the primary outcome. Whereas when the physicians added up the entire score, they were a lot less accurate. And that potentially could limit generalizability, but as Ian says, maybe we'd be better in clinical practice, or maybe we'd have an app to help us out with this later.
The app will come, I promise.
Excellent.
The fourth thing we wanted to talk about was that there were two primary outcomes, death at 30 days and serious adverse events by 14 days. Why not just have one primary outcome and the rest being secondary?
Well, this is a composite outcome. And again, other risk scales only look at mortality. And as you know, that is obviously very important, but there's a lot of other bad things that happen to people that we thought were very important to be included in this primary outcome. So some occurred during admission that they ended up being intubated or having an MI or going on to need dialysis. Those are all bad things. But we also wanted to include returning to the ED within 14 days and being admitted. So emerge docs don't like to see their patients come back, but if they're okay in the second visit and go home, then we're reassured. But if turns out the patient actually had to be admitted on that second visit, that's more of concern and raise the issue of whether maybe they should have been admitted the first time around.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things we want to push you a little bit on. There are a lot of things that we are concerned about when we're deciding to send patients home from the emergency department, but not all serious adverse events are created equal. So here we looked at admission to a monitored unit, endotracheal intubation, non-invasive ventilation, MI, major procedures, but also relapse and readmission to hospital. So let's look at that relapse and admission to hospital specifically, because we're not sure classifying it as a serious adverse event makes sense. Unless something else accompanied that admission, like an intubation or an MI, which would have been caught in the other serious adverse events, and an admission by itself is not a bad thing, because the only other option would have been admitting those patients on the index visit. Having a few patients come back is just good medicine. Admitting 100 patients to prevent 20 of them from having to come back for an admission without any other complications is, well, probably a little crazy.
Well, I could tell you at our last investigators meeting, we argued for hours about this point, but we have stuck to our guns. We first designed the initial study 10 years ago and again debated it at length. And the majority of eMERGE physicians feel that a patient coming back and then requiring admission is not desirable. So otherwise you're doing this like trial of home as a strategy. And I think for elderly patients with heart failure, that's really not the greatest strategy. We'll send you home and see how you do. You may have to come back, but, you know, good luck to you.
Well, mention.
However, I agree it's debatable. And do you know why we have a composite outcome? Because this study would have taken like 25 years if we accumulated enough deaths. So from a practical point of view, you can't, not enough patients die, fortunately, that's the only outcome. But secondly, we really believe these other outcomes are clinically relevant.
Well, mentioned in the discussion that admission of the patients could be a confounder because intensive treatment could prevent an adverse event. The opposite could also be true with the admission causing adverse events like clots, stress GI bleeds, unnecessary testing, or even unnecessary interventions such as revascularization, just because the patient was in hospital.
Well, that's part of our point. So admission to hospital is not the be-all and end-all, and a lot of patients, you know, get hospital-acquired infections that are hard to shake off. So being in hospital is not necessarily a good thing. I think we're agreeing on that. I think in Canada we're very pragmatic and that we're quite comfortable sending a lot of patients home. Our colleagues in the U.S. are more inclined to admit almost everybody. So application of this score might lead to fewer admissions in the U.S. I don't think it's going to decrease admissions in Canada, it might slightly increase.
Well, that's exactly it. The decision we're considering here is to admit or not to admit. And we think it's probably reasonable to think about whether an admission would have actually prevented the adverse events that we're looking at here. If admission can't prevent adverse events, it's unclear how this score is going to help me in clinical practice. We will probably only be able to see those patient-oriented outcomes if this scale is prospectively tested in a randomized controlled trial. While the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale may improve sensitivity, this study doesn't allow us to see whether increasing admissions would actually decrease serious adverse events. And in a system that's already pretty full, it's unclear what benefit exists in admitting more patients.
Well, I agree with part of that. but for sure, we don't think, you know, otherwise we just admit everybody, but we don't see that as reasonable or appropriate or in the best interest of the patient. The point of the scale is to help us to figure out the highest risk patients, so we admit the correct patients. So if a patient is clearly low risk, I think you can feel more comfortable sending them home, assuming they've got good support at home and reasonable follow-up.
The last point we wanted to talk about was follow-up. So serious adverse events within 30 days is exactly what we care about when making decisions on disposition. However, most of the follow-up data was from health records and telephone follow-up. They say their follow-up was very complete, but I don't see any numbers for how often they relied on hospital records versus phone calls. And even though the Canadian system is pretty good, we know lots of patients can move between hospitals and even provinces and therefore can get lost.
Yeah, this is always an issue, but in fact, we're pretty proud of our follow-up because, like, there's not, again, very few studies to follow patients prospectively as we did, using either return visits to the ED or by phoning them and asking them if they had to go back to the hospital, or the final arbiter was the coroner's records to see if they'd actually died. We're pretty pleased actually with our success in following these patients prospectively.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for taking the time to talk nerdy with us. Is there anything else that you wanted to say about the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale?
Well, we think it's ready to be used right now. Its intent is not to say admit yes or no, like an ankle rule. This is to provide additional information to the clinician who has to also then incorporate all the other issues I just mentioned about their social situation, ability for follow-up, ability to optimize therapy on discharge when you finally then put together your recommendation to admit or discharge. So this is a more sophisticated tool to help. We are ongoing in our efforts to further study it, and we are actually evaluating a somewhat leaner model that leaves out the BNP because a lot of, if not most, Canadian hospital emergency departments do not have access to acute NT-proBNP. Personally, I think we should aim for that because internationally the NT-proBNP is recognized as being very helpful, not only in identifying patients, but we've shown how useful it is in predicting serious outcomes.
All right, so let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SJEM's conclusion.
So we agree that the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale has the potential utility to standardize admission practices.
And how about an SJEM bottom line?
So the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale can probably help make disposition decisions by accurately predicting the 30-day rate of serious adverse events in patients with acute heart failure. However, we would love to see this scale validated in an RCT so that we can see patient-oriented outcomes before it's used widely. And from what I understand, that is currently being planned by Dr. Steele.
And how about a case resolution, Justin?
So you perform a walk test and your patient remains asymptomatic with a heart rate below 100 and an oxygen saturation over 98% for 3 minutes. You determine that she's low risk, both by your clinical assessment and using the components of the Ottawa Heart Failure Risk Scale. Based on this assessment, you engage in a shared decision-making conversation and she decides that she would like to be treated as an outpatient, but she will follow up as soon as possible with her primary care physician.
Then how are you going to take this information, this new publication that's hot off the press, and apply it clinically?
So this information can help make shared decisions with patients presenting to the emergency department with acute heart failure.
And what are you going to say at the patient's bedside then, Justin?
So I would tell my patient that there's a new scoring system that can help us decide which patients with acute heart failure should be admitted to hospital. There's moderate evidence that it can predict who is at risk for serious adverse events. Do you want to go through the scale together and decide whether you should be treated in the hospital or at home?
All right, it's time for the Keener contest. And last week's winner was a repeat winner from Poland. And every time he's won, and I think it's his third time winning, it might be his fourth. Every time he's won, I think I've mispronounced his name. So I'll probably do it again. It was Jarek Gakwa from Poland. He knew 1977 was when glucagon was first proposed as a pharmacologic way to treat esophageal foreign bodies. Justin, do you have a keener contest question?
Yeah. So anyone who's ever been to Ottawa, the birthplace of this scale and home of Dr. Ian Steele, knows that it's home to the UNESCO Heritage Rideau Canal. Our question is, what was the number one cause of death among laborers constructing the Rideau Canal?
And should we give them the hint that it wasn't acute heart failure?
I think that's pretty reasonable.
All right. So if you know the answer to what was the number one cause of death among laborers constructing the Rideau Canal, send your answer to the sjam@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize.
Hey, SJammers. Corey Heights here from Academic Emergency Medicine. Now it's your turn. What do you think of this episode? Tweet your comments using the hashtag SGEMHOP. What questions do you have for Dr. Steele and his team? Ask them on the SGEM blog. The best social media feedback will be published in Academic Emergency Medicine. Also, don't forget those of you who are subscribers to Academic Emergency Medicine can head over to the homepage with the link in the blog and show notes to get CME credit for this podcast and article.
Thank you, Justin, for helping put together another great SGEMHOP.
You know, it's always a pleasure and an honor to be allowed to grace the hallowed halls of the SGEM. Talk to you again soon.
And thank you, Ian, for coming on the SGEM and publishing so many high-quality, clinically relevant EM research papers.
Well, I want to thank you guys both for your tremendous efforts to get the word out. We create the evidence, but it's useless unless you guys get the word out. So thank you for that.
Our pleasure. But as our guest skeptic, can you give the SGEM tagline?
For sure. Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.